trying to kill me and the toaster's been laughing at me.
The doll is trying to kill my husband.
Yep, here's your problem. Someone set this thing to evil.
You unlock this door with the key of imagination. You're moving into a land of both shadow and substance, of things and ideas.
Hello and welcome to Sound, Sight, and Mind, the Twilight Zone podcast where three brothers talk about Twilight Zone three episodes at a time. I am Stephen Andrade, and here with me, as always, are Chris Andrade.
Hello.
And Ken Andrade.
Hello.
So, I don't know about you guys, but one of the things that I love about Twilight Zone is the episodes that are more kind of horror-bent.
Yes.
Or kind of go for the fear factor more so than any kind of fantasy or sci-fi whimsy. And tonight we're going to talk about a couple episodes that I think are tops in terms of being spooky, just all-around awesome Twilight Zone episodes. And we're going to talk about one more that's not so good. But we're all dealing with the common theme of dolls. Aren't they fun? Little dolls.
Nice little dolls.
Nice little harmless dolls. Can never harm a fly, except when they do. So we're going to start off talking about the great episode, one of my favorite episodes of all time, The Dummy, Season 3, Episode 33, written by Rod Serling, directed by Abner Biberman, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, starring Cliff Robertson, Frank Sutton, and I guess you could call it almost a cameo at the very end of the episode by a man named George Murdoch. We'll talk about that in a little bit. And here is Rod Serling's opening monologue.
You're watching a ventriloquist named Jerry Etherson, a voice thrower par excellence. His alter ego sitting atop his lap is a brass stick of kindling with the sobriquet Willie. In a moment, Mr. Etherson and his knotty pine partner will be booked into one of the out-of-the-way bistros, that small, dark, intimate place known as the Twilight Zone.
So a little quick rundown of the plot. Ventriloquist Jerry Etherson is doing a show at a, looks like a little supper club with his dummy Willie, and right from the get-go, he looks very uncomfortable. He's sweating, he's kind of stammering a little. He doesn't look like he's completely comfortable with how the show is going, even though the crowd seems to eat it up and they love Willie's corny jokes. As he comes off the stage, it seems like he gets bitten by Willie, the dummy. And then he goes back to his dressing room, throws the dummy on the couch, and takes out a bottle from the drawer and starts drinking. His agent, Frank, comes in, sees Jerry drinking again, and proceeds to unload on him about the fact that he's been, feels like he's been drinking too much and that he's got some issues, whereas Jerry repeats his assertion to Frank that Willie the dummy is in fact alive. He believes that Willie is telling jokes he's never heard before, doing things he doesn't know how to do, moving when he doesn't make a move. And Frank believes that this is all in Jerry's head and he just needs a psychiatrist, but Jerry figures that the only way to fix this is to not use Willie anymore. So he decides to get a different dummy, pulls another dummy out of his chest, named Goofy Goggles.
Goofy Goggles.
Because people with glasses are funny.
They always are. Takes Goofy Goggles out for his next show at the club. Does some even cornier, cheesier jokes. But he's happy with the show. He thinks it goes over well. And then he's packing up to leave. And as he does, he hears Willie's voice asking him why he's leaving him in the box. As Jerry goes to leave, he keeps hearing Willie taunting him more and more and laughing at him until finally he snaps, runs back into his dressing room, picks up the doll in the dark, smashes it, breaks it into pieces, and then turns on the light and sees that it was not actually Willie that he smashed, but it was Goofy Goggles. Somehow he smashed the other dummy. And then Willie, who is sitting on the couch, proceeds to talk to him and tell him that Jerry brought him to life by saying, making him say words, making him tell jokes, moving his lips until Willie had his own life. Fade to black, comes up on another supper club. Willie and Jerry are introduced by the MC, and as they come out, the camera spins around, and we can see that Willie is now the ventriloquist, and the dummy looks like Jerry. They have switched places. Willie has become the dominant personality and is now pulling all the strings. So, this one, like I said, this is one of the ones that's one of the creepier Twilight Zones. It's one of my favorite ones. It's got great layers of psychological horror, as well as some really incredible camera tricks that I think make it really successful. What do you guys think?
I love this episode so much. Scared the shit out of me when I was a kid. mainly for the last act of the episode when he's really running away from Willie, and it's when the camera is completely canted, so it always looks like he's running off balance. And there's the maniacal laughter.
That laughter, yeah, we're going to have to play a clip of that laughter, because that Willie's laughter is the sound of pure madness. I love it. It is so creepy.
Yeah, let's hear it. Yeah, it's so scary, and the other thing I love about it, and I think the reason I loved it when I was younger, is this is one of those episodes that it's not really a morality play. There's not a lot to unpack in terms of messages or layers. I mean, there's some things about Jerry's alcoholism that you could take away from it. That's in there, but for the most part, it's a story about this guy being tormented by this devil, and then in the end, just the neat twist of, like, the old switcheroo is what I think Serling calls it in the end monologue. It's just a very simple little horror story.
In common parlance.
yeah.
It's really well acted, and you should point out that Cliff Robertson actually did the voices himself. So that maniacal laughter, Willie's voice, that's actually him doing it. I don't think he was actually doing the ventriloquist act, per se. I think he just...
No, that was all... Yeah, yeah, that was all recorded in post.
But you know what? In neat attention to detail, he does a good job of moving his lips a little bit and making it look kind of plausible as far as that goes. And then Frank, his agent, is played by Frank Sutton, who is the drill sergeant on Gomer Pyle, you know, and does the kind of, you know, slightly exasperated, domineering thing very well. But it's a very well acted episode. You know, it's definitely got that unexplained supernatural thing at the end with the. He becomes the dummy. The dummy becomes the, as you said, kind of a cameo there. Although it's interesting, the dummy, I think, looks less like the actor and more like the actor when he was playing John F. Kennedy in PT-109.
But, yeah, the neat thing about the ending is that up until that end, it could just be a psychological thing, you know? It could all be in Jerry's head.
Totally.
And it's just the end when you find out it really is real. And that's one of the neat things. And that's the great dynamic, too, between Jerry and his agent Frank, is that Frank honestly wants to help him. And he does think it's all in his head. And up until the very end, if you didn't know it was Twilight Zone, you'd kind of think that Frank was right.
Yeah, because when he's running through the back alleys and stuff, I think there's one shot of the silhouette of Willie sitting in a chair in there, but otherwise it's just the laughter carrying through that whole scene, and he's just running around panicked. And even when he busts into his room, there's no indication that it's anything but in his mind. And up until that point, I can't remember, have we seen Willie talk freely?
We've not seen Willie talk freely. We do see a shot before it goes to commercial of Willie winking on the couch that I believe he sees in the mirror as he's looking in the mirror in the dressing room.
Right, and you see Willie kind of turning at times looking the other way, but
it's done. But the turn is done off camera. It's that trick where the camera pans away,
yeah,
and it pans back, and he's in a different position. And there's even another shot, the shot before it goes to commercial. Jerry throws a small like shaving mirror at Willie, and then the last shot is the mirror reflecting Willie's face, cracked right down the center.
Right down the middle, which even suggests as a trope the kind of split personality.
Exactly.
Thing. Mm-hmm. Right up to the very end, and even when he's saying, "You made me, you gave me life," it could very well be in his head. And he's played as such a sympathetic and kind of pathetic character when he's running and he tries to ask the chorus girl out for a drink.
Oh, God,
just to kind of get away from it, and she thinks he's assaulting her. But it's done really well as far as you know, the playing off of the, you know, sounding desperate and becoming physically aggressive.
Yeah, actually, if we have the audio for that, if you can play that when he's talking to her at the end when she gets scared and runs away.
Oh, sure.
No, Noreen, you're a good kid, and I've always thought you were a good kid, and I've always wanted to
maybe have a drink with
honey, listen. Wait a minute, Noreen. Look.
What's the matter with you, Jerry?
There's nothing the matter with me. No, I'm not sick. I just want to have a drink with you. Don't you understand? I don't want to be alone. I keep hearing those voices. That Willie is bugging me. No, wait a minute. That Willie is bugging me. Wait a minute.
Yeah, because he just, you can tell he's just losing it right there, you know? He's just like, I mean, think of it. If somebody came up to you and said, like, that doll's been bugging me, that dummy's been bugging me, I just need to go out and get a drink. Like, he'd be like, okay, bye.
And that's another instance where they're using that very signature Twilight Zone cant and angle camera work.
Oh, my God,
but that's one where when it starts falling apart, we actually see the camera tilt,
right?
Where it like pushes in on him, and all of a sudden the camera goes, and then it's just all that like crazy off balance running, where you really feel like, oh my gosh, he's just like
that
desperately
one
stumbling
shot,
through.
That one shot where he runs back to the ramp that leads up to the stage entrance. He grabs a hold of there's a pole there, a little handrail that he runs and grabs it and spins around to get up that ramp. And with the way the camera is canted, it gives it such an incredible sense of force and motion. It really would not be as well done if it had been shot straight. So that was a great use of the Dutch angles there.
And there's so many just little instances of really attention paid to what Willie's doing. Like, I mean, the whole sequence where it's the first time alone in the dressing room with Willie and Jerry, and it's all the panning away and panning back, and he keeps changing positions. That sequence is flawless. But when Jerry and his manager are having their kind of final blowout argument, and his manager has Willie in his hands, he's like shaking him, and they're yelling at each other, Willie's face is turned a little bit and his eyes are staring right at the manager. And it's such a cool little shot if you pay attention to it. He's just, the way that he's looking at him, it's just great. It's this great
I
little...
I have not noticed that. I'll have to go back and rewatch it.
It's so good. It's just him watching the manager and kind of like, I don't know if it's out of sort of he... You know, what the motivation is. Is he just kind of playing mischief maker and just wants to mess with these guys? Or is he concerned for his own safety, you know, as this fragile dummy demon thing? I don't know, but it's just a cool little thing.
There's lots of little things, like you said. The very beginning when Jerry's doing his act, I think we talked in our very first episode about sweat in the Twilight Zone, and they used it very effectively to show when people are under stress. Jerry up on the stage, again, it has that Twilight Zone dripping with sweat. And, you know, it'd be stage lights, so it would be warm up there, but it's definitely more the stress of doing a show and not knowing where the jokes are coming from.
Yeah, he has just enough of that little stammer in some of his responses that you can tell that he's not quite sure of the responses he's getting from Willie. So
yeah.
Good.
The other thing I want to ask you guys what you think about it. There's just a weird little scene when he's going out to go on stage with, I believe it's when he's going on stage with Goofy Goggles. He leaves his dressing room, and then two of the chorus girls tell him to ask him to do the Willy voice, like make him talk, make him talk. And then while his door is closed, Willie's voice comes from inside the room and says something, and they laugh, thinking that, you know, he did it. Although, obviously, Jerry doesn't believe that he did it. You know, he knows Willie did it. And then he runs off. And then there's a shot of the two chorus girls opening the door, looking in on Willie, and then, like, turning around and looking back at Jerry. And it's shot very strangely. It almost seems, and I don't know if this was the intention or not, or if I'm just reading too much into it, it almost seems as if they were setting it up as if they were in on it somehow. Did you guys get that, or am I just reading way too much?
I don't remember that, honestly. I'd have to go back and look.
It was like, I don't know if they meant to be like a red herring, like people were doing things to mess with them, but it just, the way that the looks on their faces were just a little odd for just people who were just amused by a dummy.
Right, yeah. I didn't know if that was just like a, kind of like looking in disbelief, or, but I guess it wouldn't make any sense for them to look into the room and
yeah,
see Willie there. Yeah,
I mean, that's a scene that I'm pretty sure in syndication that scene always got trimmed down. Yeah,
yeah, because watching it this time, I noticed that too, where I didn't recall that scene at all.
Yeah. Now let's talk about the jokes, because those are some great jokes. Yeah. I mean, out in front of the Ritz Savoy. That's, can't get any better
than that. That's where I live.
Out in front of the Ritz Savoy. Yeah. Saw this broad walking down a street. It was a broad street.
Well, it is better than the goofy goggles material. I mean, let's be honest.
Well, that's the funny thing, too, is that they have the scene while he's doing his goofy goggles act, and his agent is talking him up to the club owner and saying, like, pretty good act, right? And he's like, what's good about it? You know, it's like, you've seen one dummy, you've seen them all. You know, it's like the same thing. It's old hat. It's vaudeville. And so there's that aspect, too, where, like, his career, you know, even then, like, it was just kind of, well, it's ventriloquism, you know, whatever, it's a gag, the jokes are old and stale, you know, there's nothing really original about it. And it's just kind of interesting, because in that way too, it's like, well, is that part of it? Is that the, you know, the fact that he's just doing this thing and there's nothing new, and it's just kind of repeating the same old jokes over and over again, has just driven him crazy?
Well, I kind of wondered about the origins of the relationship between him and Willie, because if he has goofy goggles with him, and it's a little weird that he doesn't have kind of an established act with goofy goggles. It's like, if you have this dummy in your back pocket and he pulls him out and he said, you know, he's going to make up a brand new act, and he sort of just starts improvising it.
Yeah.
That's why the manager's sort of disbelieving. He's like, a brand new act, but you would think he would have material. So I'm kind of wondering, like, he has this other dummy, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yet he insists on using Willie, and it doesn't seem like he's this superstar, successful, huge act where he needs to keep using Willie to survive. So is it just this weird codependence that sort of, it's like his alcoholism. It's just, he's sort of gone down this rabbit hole and now he can't stop, even though he's got, you know, he's got the other dummy right there. Why didn't he trash Willie a long time ago? So,
yeah, I mean, I'm sure we're over psychoanalyzing this. I'm pretty sure when Rod Sterling was writing, he wasn't looking into the deep psychological reasons why he would be in this abusive relationship.
I know. And this story was actually submitted by a viewer.
Oh, really?
Sterling wrote it, and they got story submissions all the time, most of which were rejected. But Sterling got this one from this random guy, and it was very broad. It was just kind of like, what if there was a ventriloquist whose dummy was alive and he couldn't control what he said?
Mm-hmm.
That's basically the gist of it. So they optioned it from this guy, and Sterling wrote the teleplay, and then they sort of communicated after and sent each other notes, mm-hmm. you know, saying, you know, the guy was very excited about it, and Sterling wrote back, yeah, sorry for all the changes, but that's how it goes, but thank you, blah, blah, blah.
I'm having trouble making the creepy chorus girls work, though, so we'll see how that goes. I just rewatched that scene. That's friggin' weird.
Yeah, right. Another really interesting random bit of trivia is, word got to Sherry Lewis, the puppeteer,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, the puppeteer behind Lamb Chop's play along, that whole thing.
Yep.
She got wind that Twilight Zone was working on a puppeteer episode, and she was desperate to be a part of it and actually contacted them and was like, I really want to do this with you. And Serling had to write her this nice letter saying, you know, I'm a huge fan of yours, but trust me, this is not anywhere near your wheelhouse. This dummy is not remotely anything associated with your image. You would need something very special.
Pretty much shot down her future children's entertainer career.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so the dummy, I think this episode is definitely up in my tops. I usually put it right around, you know, my number one episode when I'm talking Twilight Zone and favorites. So it's a great one, really well shot. It's music is stock music for this episode, yep. It does it really well. It was a good choice of music. They got good cues to use. It doesn't feel like like we talked about with Stopover in a Small Town, how the music just doesn't seem to fit, and a couple other episodes
But this one works.
Yeah, they did a very smart job of picking the cues for the scenes. And everything blends together really well. One more little bit of trivia I want to lay on before we move on. The ending scene where Willie is now the living man, played by George Murdoch in makeup to resemble the dummy. And he's got the dummy of Jerry on his lap, who's now doing the jokes. The Jerry dummy was actually designed by a Disney animator named Frank Campbell. He was a caricaturist who used to sign his work Tee-hee. They got in touch with him. He did some sketches based on photos of Cliff Robertson, and all the caricatures that he did were used as the basis for crafting that dummy.
That's cool.
That is cool.
I believe that those original dummies, at least the Willie original dummy, now resides in David Copperfield's collection.
That's correct. They have a replica outside the Twilight Zone Tower of Terror, but it's in David Copperfield's collection.
That's pretty cool, though. So, moving on from the dummy to another episode about a dummy, Season 5, Twilight Zone showed its thriftiness in reusing props with the episode Caesar and Me, Season 5, which, as we know, is the final season of Twilight Zone, when quality, I think we can agree, kind of took a dip on a lot of episodes, and I think this is one of them. Season 5, Episode 28, directed by Robert Butler, written by Adele T. Strassfield, I believe one of the only women writers to get a full story credit on the Twilight Zone.
First and only, I believe.
And this one aired April 10th, 1964. It stars Jackie Cooper, who was a former child actor and somebody I recognized as playing Perry White in Richard Donner's Superman movie. Right. Also starring Suzanne Cupido as the most sinister little malicious brat you can ever see on a Twilight Zone episode. Sarah Selby, Stafford Rep, who is somebody that I know of from the old Batman TV show, the Adam West.
Jason Begora.
Yep, he played Chief O'Hara. And then a couple other people. Yeah, this one is... it may have Willie going by a different name, but it is certainly no dummy. So here is Rod Serling's opening narration.
Jonathan West, ventriloquist, a master of voice manipulation. A man late of Ireland with a talent for putting words into other people's mouths. In this case, the other person is a dummy aptly named Caesar. A small splinter with large ideas. A wooden tyrant with a mind and a voice of his own, who is about to talk Jonathan West into the Twilight Zone.
All right, so basically what we have here is another unsuccessful ventriloquist played by Jackie Cooper, Jonathan West. He's pawning his stuff to pay for his rent at the boarding house where he stays. The woman who runs it, her niece, is this little girl, Susan, who seems to be spat up.
Evil incarnate?
From the seventh layer of hell.
Little Shit, I think.
Yes,
right.
Susan, a.k.a. Little Shit, who, you know, we first meet her.
Can we just say that her first introduction, she attempts to get him with a poison dart from a blowgun.
Well, as she says,
sight on it.
As she says, it wasn't a poison one. It was just a regular dart. There was no poison on that one.
It's just kids being kids.
Just kids being kids. Anyways, Jonathan's dummy, who again played by Willie, is now dubbed Little Caesar. And as we soon learn, is alive and talks to him and tells him that in order to survive, they've got to start pulling some big heists. So, because their employment status is not too great, there's a scene when Jonathan and Caesar go to an audition at a nightclub and fail miserably with really stale jokes. Caesar berates Jonathan into going and robbing the nightclub. So they sneak in, break into the safe. They're seen by the night watchman when they're there, but they manage to pull it off by saying that the nightclub owner wanted to see them, and he must have left before they got there. And then they get back to the apartment and back to the boarding house and are talking, and Susan overhears them talking and decides to inform the police. The police come in, ask Jonathan about where he was the night before when the nightclub was robbed, and Jonathan suddenly turns into Lenny from Of Mice and Men and basically breaks down, tells him it was all Caesar's idea, and of course Caesar isn't saying anything, so the police take him away, one thinks to, you know, the men with white coats. And then when Susan is left all alone with Little Caesar, Caesar says, "Hey, you look like a pretty hip chick, why don't we break out of this this house and go live a life on the lam? You still got that poison blow dart gun that you can use on your aunt?" Or something along those lines. Basically, he says, "You're evil, I'm evil, let's go be evil together. First, you gotta whack your aunt." And that's the end of the episode. And yeah, everything that the dummy had going for it in terms of depth, visual flair, psychological layers is pretty much absent in this one. That's my take anyways. Thoughts?
I didn't hate it as much as you did.
What?
Okay. Explain yourself.
Okay.
Damning with faint praise.
First of all, the fact that they were doing another, you know, talking dummy thing just basically a year later, that was odd. But I really liked Jackie Cooper's performance. He's a solid actor, and I thought he played it fairly well and understated. You know, he's playing Irish, but not the over-the-top Irish that you saw in a lot of stuff in this period, you know, cross-referencing Stafford Rep as Chief O'Hara. You know, it wasn't a blatant character.
Not even with the, "What would you like for dinner, Caesar? How about some of that nice potato soup?"
Well, okay, yeah, but that wasn't his fault. That was the script. And that's why women never wrote scripts again. It's not the strongest script, but I thought what he did with the material was good. Susan, that was, I said as soon as she came out, I said, "Well, I was not expecting that," where she comes out right away with the blowgun, and then, you know, that, okay, mischievous kid, whatever, but then when she starts bringing, "I bet you couldn't even find a job, could you? Wait, who the hell are you, kid?" Yeah. I thought that was a bit much, to put it mildly. Just a side note, she would later change her name, the actress, from Susan Capito to Morgan Brittany, and she played a kind of femme fatale character on, was it Dallas or Dynasty?
Same difference.
One of those. Yeah, one of those 80s prime.
Big shoulder pads and poofy hair.
But, you know, kept playing the dangerous woman throughout her career there. But, you know, it wasn't, the setup wasn't good, but just it was written in much broader strokes than the dummy. It was already kind of a tired plot, so you kind of knew, you know, well, where it was going. But I thought, you know, the dummy driving him to a life of crime thing was an interesting twist, if only because of what, you know, later the Batman writers would do with it. Years later, first in the comic books and then really noticeably in the Batman animated series with the ventriloquist and Scarface character. It had to have some inspiration from this.
Well, the thing is, though, with Caesar and Me, my problem, I think, is that there's no gray area. Unlike the dummy, where there's a lot, you're not sure until the very end what's happening. In Caesar and Me, it's pretty much obvious from the get-go. Caesar is alive, and that's that, you know? So there's no mystery to it. I think this is the biggest praise I can give this episode. I feel that there could have been a much more interesting episode written out of it, taking the major story beats and just finessing it, making it so that when Caesar is talking, either his mouth doesn't move if Jonathan West is not there to move it, to sort of gray that area of, is it in
but
his head?
But then you're just remaking the dummy.
Yeah, but at least it would be more interesting. I wouldn't mind if it was remaking the dummy if it was more interesting, because then I think it would be more interesting in the fact that you're left with that question of, is this like a split personality, like even more so? Where, because Jonathan West, Jackie Cooper's character, is so pathetic, especially at the end. Like I said, he reminds me of Lenny in A Mice and Men when he's just like, tell him, Caesar, tell him I didn't hurt anybody. Tell him I wouldn't do that. And it's just, he's just so almost childlike. It's pathetic. And so I feel like if they had made it more of a gray area, if Caesar was possibly a different manifestation of his personality somehow, you know, there's a throwaway line about how he got Caesar because his old owner, I think, like, he got married or, like, found a woman or something.
Left him for a woman. Yeah.
But yeah, I thought that was kind of a neat wink to the fact that, look, everyone, we know we've done this one already. You know, I won't leave you like the last guy.
Maybe.
Well, I thought that was, see, that's kind of the interesting concept that I would have enjoyed more if that seems like a weird thing, saying, like, your old owner left you for a woman. And then in the end, when you see Caesar, you know, convincing this girl to murder her aunt and then run away to New York with them, it's like, okay, so as opposed to the dummy where Willie was this devil with this really interesting relationship with Jerry personally.
Right.
Here you get the sense that Caesar is more the, like, devil on your shoulder who gets passed from person to person, kind of like a monkey's paw sort of scenario.
Right.
So I feel like there's some cool stuff that you could sort of play around with there. Or the fact that Jonathan says that he's like a puppet maker's apprentice or something in Ireland.
Right.
If there was something more there to where, you know, Caesar was actually his creation that went wrong or something like that. It's just kind of odd to me that he was maybe this skilled tradesman and then he comes to America to make his fortune and he's too dim to realize that, you know, Caesar isn't even a good magic dummy. Like, his jokes suck. They go into the audition with the wooden leg named Smith. Like, I feel like you should know this ain't going to happen for you. So I do think there are, like, little avenues that could have made this more interesting. But
yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a great episode. I just didn't have the visceral negative reaction, Steve.
Well, I think part of it is, like I said, Dummy is one of my favorites. So, you know, just seeing this, which is such a pale shadow, it's just, you know, disappointing. And also, it's really sad that Willie had to go and, you know, reprise his role, basically, and do this really terrible script. His script was much better. Willie deserved better.
Yeah. And lacking the, like you said, the visual flair, I was reading about it, the guys who produced it, I don't remember if it was a director or producer or something, they seemed kind of proud of the shots when they're shooting Jackie Cooper sitting and you see Willie walking through frame. They thought that was kind of like a neat trick, whereas when I saw that, I was like, this is ridiculous. You know, he just bounces back and forth through the frame.
That's a happy Muppet hop.
boom, boom. Yeah, it's just like you said, there is none of that nuance or none of that intrigue from the dummy at all.
Yeah. Yeah.
I was trying to do the math and I forgot to do it, but my theory is that Susan kills her aunt, goes to New York with Willie, and then becomes Jodie Foster in Taxi Driver.
That's who she totally reminded me of. Yeah, that's, you know, Caesar starts her down a life of crime. Next thing, exactly. Next thing you know, she's turning tricks for Harvey Keitel. I think we're onto something there.
There you go. Yeah. You know, the director, actually, he directed the pilots for Star Trek and Hill Street Blues. He's actually a very successful television director.
A lot of pedigree.
Well, I mean, you can only do so much with the words you're given. So let's move away from Willie. Let's let him rest in peace or in pieces, and talk about the last episode we're going to talk about now. Another one of my personal favorites, also from season 5, Living Doll, episode 6 from season 5, originally aired November 1st, 1963, directed by Richard Serafian, written by, now this is an interesting thing, the credit was Charles Beaumont, but the actual writer for this episode was Jerry Soule. Jerry Soule and Charles Beaumont plotted this together, but Jerry Soule was the sole writer of the actual script. And the reason for that, found out doing some reading, Charles Beaumont started having issues where his memory was failing and he wasn't able to remember things he had written. He was having trouble when he was pitching plots. He had trouble trying to come up with things on the spot. He ended up going into kind of a spiral of drinking and depression. And it turned out when he finally went to the doctor to be examined, he had a disease they couldn't figure out if it was Alzheimer's or another early onset dementia disease. But basically, a lot of his later work was ghostwritten by others, basically almost as favors to him, because he had a lot of friends in the business and he would be able to come up with some plots, but he wouldn't be able to do the actual writing. And this is one of those cases, which is, it's really sad. He ended up dying, I think he was only 39 years old. Whoa. Yeah.
Yeah, it was. They still don't know exactly what he had.
No.
And the writers who were ghostwriting for him were actually trying to give him the proceeds, and he insisted on splitting the paychecks.
Yeah, a little sad side note. Charles Beaumont did write a number of excellent Twilight Zone episodes, and we'll talk about some more of those as time goes on. Also, I want to point out the music in this one is probably my favorite, or one of my favorite soundtracks to an episode of Twilight Zone, composed by Bernard Herrmann. Of course, famously the score of Psycho, and as we talked about, he composed the score for the pilot episode, Where Is Everybody? And this episode, Living Doll, stars the wonderfully nasty Telly Savalas.
In Twilight Zone sweat.
Oh, yep. He's so good in this. He's so good. Mary LaRoche, Tracy Stratford, and as the voice of Talkie Tina, the sinister doll, June Foray. And here is Rod Serling's opening narration.
Talkie Tina, the doll that does everything. A lifelike creation of plastic and springs and painted smile. To Eric Strater, she is a most unwelcome addition to his household. Without her, he'd never enter Twilight Zone.
So, the story begins as Telly Savalas, playing Eric Strater, is home, and his wife and their daughter come home from shopping, and he asks, you know, what they've bought. And his daughter, Christy, has a new doll named Talkie Tina, which you wind up, and it moves its arms and opens its eyes and says, "My name is Talkie Tina, and I love you." It comes out from this that Eric's wife, Annabelle, had Christy before they were married. She is from either a previous marriage or we don't know the exact situation. And Eric apparently has some resentment about this because he himself is unable to father any children. And he brings that up many times, which I'll talk about in a little bit.
many times.
His wife Annabelle makes a says a little offhand remark about how the doll would be a good playmate for their daughter, and his response is, "Oh, but lacking a brother or sister because I can't have children, right?" And so basically, he starts it off on a very defensive, belligerent note. So when he's alone with Talkie Tina and winds up the doll, it speaks to him as well, but it says things like, "I don't think I like you, and I think I could even hate you, and finally, I'm going to kill you." Things escalate as he is caught in almost a cat and mouse game with the doll, who is says these things only when Annabelle and Christy are out of the room. He tries to throw the doll away, but the doll reappears in Christy's bed after he receives a phone call from Talkie Tina, which he thinks is a neat trick somehow that his wife has engineered to get back at him. Finally, he snaps and tries to destroy the doll using a vise. He tries to crush its head in a vise. He tries a welding torch. He tries a buzzsaw, and nothing is working. And when he goes back upstairs, his wife finds his wife packing a suitcase, saying that basically they're going to leave because he's being so irrational and hostile towards them. And he finally relents and says, if I give the doll back, will that help?" So he puts the gets the doll back to give back to Christy, and they go to sleep. And he wakes up in the middle of the night, thinks he hears something. Eric goes out to the staircase, trips over Talkie Tina, falls down the stairs, and dies. Annabelle runs down to see Eric's body, and Tina opens her eyes and says, "My name is Talkie Tina, and you better be nice to me." So, yeah, this one is so goddamn good. I could talk about this one for hours on end, I think, but we'll try to limit ourselves to a little less than that. So what are your guys' thoughts?
I love this episode. Again, it's right in that wheelhouse for me of creepy, straight-ahead sort of horror-skewed Twilight Zone. And like you said, Telly Savalas is so great in this episode. And the scenes where it's just him and the doll going back and forth when they're at the dinner table and mm-hmm. they're just kind of, you know, sussing each other out, and, you know, he's saying, you know, "So you do have feelings," and she says, "Doesn't everybody?" And when later he's trying to destroy her, he puts her head in the vise and he says, "I thought you had feelings," and she says, "I can take it if you can," or whatever mm-hmm. she said. Yeah. It's so, so good. And I love also when he finally, you know, when he finally says, "If I give the doll back, will it make everything right?" And he goes to get her. And I forget what she says when he takes her out of the trash can.
I remember. She says, "My name is Talkie Tina, and I don't forgive you."
Right, yeah. Right. And then he has that, like, desperate strain. Just shut up. Shut up. He's just...
Yeah. He's almost crying there. Yeah, it's great.
It's so, so good. It's just shot great. It's paced great. The two performances are great. I mean, it's all... Like, when I first saw it, and he's doing those lines where he's talking to Annabelle and he's saying, "But I don't love her because I'm incapable of love, you know,
because mm-hmm. like, I'm only her stepfather, not her father."
Right. The first time I saw it, I was kind of like jumping the gun on being judgy and like, "Oh, this is stupid." But then when he's sort of breaking it down about the kind of like psycho babble and sort of hinting at the history of the therapy that she's been going through and everything, it's just so great. I love it.
I will say that it's almost as if this episode takes place the day after he gets the results back of his sperm test, because everything is like, "You mean I can't father children?" Yeah, it's like well, every conversation fresh. Ends with, "Oh, you mean because my penis is shooting blanks, right? Is that what you mean?"
Well, yeah, I mean, there is that, but again, you got a half hour. There were a lot of nice things, though. I mean, when I first saw it, it's like, oh, yeah, here's Telly Savalas, and it's almost like his character in The Dirty Dozen. He really has a problem with females, doesn't he?
Mm.
Right. But when you realize it's all his own insecurity. Mm-hmm. And when they first come in with the doll, they've come in from shopping, and clearly it's been a little like mother-daughter bonding time. They have, you know, their various parcels and things. And he is sitting at his little work desk there trying to figure out the household bills. And so his first objection is like, how much did that thing cost? We talked about this. She doesn't need another doll. You know, so he's there. They don't go into detail on that, but there's obviously some financial stress there.
Mm-hmm.
He's just feeling inadequate as a man, you know, as a provider. He's not, you know, he's having trouble paying the bills. And that's a, you know, when you're having trouble making ends meet, that's a huge stress on any relationship. Then the whole thing about he doesn't feel like he's really her father, although she, the girl, Christy, responds very well to him, calls him daddy, very adoringly.
There's a very nice scene in the beginning after his initial objections, and Christy comes down and he says, that's okay. Like, she apologizes to him for Talkie Tina, and his response is, that's okay, Christy, daddy was just being silly. And it's very nice.
It's all daddy's fault.
Yeah, it's really a nice little moment. It shows that he does care, and he's a good father once he gets past the kind of chip on his shoulder, or past the, you know, the elephant in the room of the fact that he will never actually be a real father.
But, you know, I wondered on that line, too, if that wasn't doing dual duty as being a little bit passive-aggressive to Annabelle, too. You know, saying, oh, no, it's all daddy's fault.
Right. It's always it's possible.
But he feels so insecure about it, and the whole thing, you know, I can't, I'll never be her real father. And that's what prompts Annabelle to start packing up, is when he goes and takes the doll away from her. Mm-hmm. It's not just that he's being bizarre about the doll, but what really, you know, breaks the camel's back there is when she grabs the doll away and she's like, but daddy, and he says, and I'm not your daddy, and storms out, you know.
Yeah, that's some cold shit. That was
really, yeah.
And it's funny because Annabelle, I mean, you don't know what other discussions and fights they've had in the past, I'm assuming several, but Annabelle is very, she's very, not submissive, I don't know what word I'm looking for, but when she says, you know, I know you got more than you bargained for with the two of us, and we'll do anything to make you happy. She's trying very hard to kind of break him down a little bit.
Yeah. What's little interesting note, she plays a very similar character of just the kind of the placid, very eager to please woman in the episode from season one, A World of His Own, where she plays the main character's kind of ideal of the perfect wife. And she plays kind of almost a similar character here, where she's just very ready to make everything work, make everything be smooth and easy, and just try to make everything the nice, happy home.
Is A World of His Own the one about the writer who tape records?
Yeah, I believe it's one of your favorites, right?
Oh, God. I hope we get to talk about that shit pile. Oh, I got some things to say about that episode.
Oh, God, I think we need to take off the docket what we're going to have for the next one and put that one on instead. Yeah,
maybe we get a one-off bonus episode where I just get 10 minutes to talk about how much I hate that episode.
Ken gets liquored up and goes on a tirade about A World of His Own. anyways, but back to this one. Yeah, she's very... Annabelle really wants to make Eric happy. But he makes it very difficult. He's just, his edges are so raw about these certain things. And it's, you know, it's just, it's something that, it seems to be driving a wedge. And like you said, they hint at, you know, previous talks with psychiatrists or psychologists. So like they have been, it's been hinted they have been going through some sort of therapy to try to get past these issues. And let's talk for a moment about the music, because like I said, this episode has one of my favorite scores, just this wonderful, simple, I only count a bit, it's basically piano and, sounds like piano bass and bassoon, clarinet. Bass clarinet.
Mm. Yeah, solo bass clarinet, and then harp and celeste.
Yeah, and just... eerie music, a little childlike in some parts. The little themes that play are very kind of childlike, which of course work perfectly with you know, a story centering around a doll. but very, very moody and atmospheric. And I can't think of any other episode, actually, you know, thinking back on it, where I remember the music as much as Living Doll.
Okay, can I say something that bugged me about this episode?
Sure.
Okay, the one thing I thought rang false in the episode was the closing narration. Do we have that?
Yeah, I did. Yes, okay, uh-huh.
Of course, we all know dolls can't really talk, and they certainly can't commit murder. But to a child caught in the middle of turmoil and conflict, a doll can become many things. Friend, defender, guardian. Especially a doll like Talkie Tina, who did talk and did commit murder in the misty region of the Twilight Zone.
Okay, this pissed me off. Because there was so much good stuff there. And, you know, again, Telly Savalas, he's not a terribly sympathetic character in terms of his nastiness and interactions. But like you said, there are moments, there's an understanding that there's problems here. The girl comes off as totally innocent, unlike the devil spawn played by Susan Capito in the previous episode we discussed. Right. I mean, she's, you know, she's just a loving, adorable little kid. And so to suggest that, okay, so now here's the kid in the middle of this conflict. So the doll, acting on her behalf, killed her stepfather.
Yeah.
Like, no, that's not it. Is it really? Yeah.
Well, it's another case of, I think, you know, again, we look at these and we rewatch them and we analyze them and we talk about all these things that I think that a lot of times the writers weren't thinking of, and stuff almost happened accidentally. I have a quote from the writer Jerry Soule about the episode. He says, "You really sympathize with the guy. If that goddamn doll kept saying those things, I'd feel the same way myself. Throw it in a damn trash can." What a simplistic evaluation of one's own work. I mean, it's so funny because there's so many layers here, and it's one of the things where it's like, well, are we just seeing things that aren't there? Or is it just that they were writing things and, you know, just maybe things that were unconsciously there just come out, and little maybe like allegorical things or metaphorical things or whatnot.
Modern lit crit, you know, authorial intent doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, but...
say whatever you want.
But yeah, so in his mind, it was just, ah, that doll was a nasty piece of shit. So of course you should throw it in the trash can. It's like, oh man, like, so maybe that's explains the ending.
But I
kind
of like that.
You kind of like what?
But I think he's right on that. I think it is. The doll's a nasty piece of shit, and that's what it is. And so, yeah, there are all these problems and things that are playing into it and exacerbating the situation and giving the doll a venue. But then, and that's what annoyed me, is it was just, okay, evil. You know, it's as the Simpsons played with it later on. Well, you got the switch set to evil. There's a problem right there. There is no real reason that Talkie Tina should be doing that right out of the gate, right?
I mean, yeah, right.
And so for it to be that, oh, she's defending the child, from what we've seen, didn't need that much in the way of defense. You know, stepdad snaps at you a little, and so we throw him down the stairs. That seems a bit harsh.
It's almost like you could have stopped before that, and the doll and the psychosis that it brings on with Telly Savalas, and whether or not that's in his head too, it becomes the impetus for Annabelle to leave him, you know, and take Christy. And maybe it's this psychotic break thing. So, yeah, the whole murder aspect does become kind of a horrific, just kind of Twilight Zone-y twisty ending. And I did crack up at that end monologue because it's funny to me to hear him go, you know, we all know dolls can't talk or commit murder, except this one did and did commit murder. Yeah. It's
just, yeah.
It's a little goofy.
Yeah, it is. But, you know, a small blight on what is otherwise a very, very well done episode.
I think so.
Yeah. It's, you know, beautifully acted, great cinematography on it. The lighting, especially when he's got Annabelle at the table saw, And he's trying to... Or not Annabelle. That's...
She just took a very dark turn.
Oh, yes. My gosh.
Oh, that's what I do when I shouldn't confuse...
Talkie Tina. Come on, give it the program.
I shouldn't confuse Evil Dead with Twilight Zone.
You found me beautiful once.
When he's got Talkie Tina at the table saw, and it's shooting off sparks as he's trying to saw through the neck. It's just so... well lit, and it's again, it's right. Like when the cinematography was on, they just had anything, they had shows that looked as good as any movie, you know, just great attention to lighting and detail, and I think it's just really excellent. And again, Telly Savalas, I just love his performance in this. His performance makes me wish that they had made a Superman movie back in 1963 or 64 and had him as Lex Luthor. Because he's just so charismatically evil, and at the same time, very human. Mm-hmm. So, anybody got anything else to say about Delightful Dolls?
Still creepy after all these years, still that's what I'd say.
It really is. Okay. So, that's it for this episode. Thank you so much for listening. Be sure to visit our Facebook page, Sound, Sight, and Mind, at SSM Podcast. Our Instagram at SSM Podcast, and you can send us emails to tell us whether or not you agree or disagree, or let us know any episodes you'd like us to talk about on future podcasts. Our email is ssmpodcast@gmail.com. Tune in next time, where we're going to be talking about another trio of episodes with a different theme. Ken, I believe this is going to be your episode to moderate, so what's the theme going to be next time?
Twisty protagonists. So basically three episodes where your main character is not what they seem.
All right.
There's one of my favorites, maybe my favorite episode of all time, which I'm excited to talk about. Mm-hmm. And
A World of His Own, right? That's the one. It's a bewitching pool, right? That's the one.
If you want to hear me just yell for an hour, A World of His Own, Bewitching Pool, get me all fired up. It's going to be great. Twisty Protagonists. We got some good stuff.
All right. And, once again, we're at the end of an episode. Do you have a tagline?
Yeah, ready?
Okay.
From Sound, Sight, and Mind, this episode has been submitted, and we don't care if you approve or not.
Oh, I like that one.
I like it.
I think that's a
not
keeper.
Not too bad, right?
I think it's a keeper.
Yes.
Oh, I think you got it. Six times the charm, right? How many of these have we done so far? What is this, four or five?
This is four.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, the last one we had the pickle bouncing, too, so that counts as an extra one. Anywho, thanks for listening.
Oh man. I had a whole pickle bounce line queued up for if we talked about Telly Savalas falling down the stairs, and I missed it.
That's my legacy for this
episode. All right. Well, thanks for listening, and tune in next time, and get those emails going, and let us know what you want to hear us talk about. So have a good one. Say goodbye, guys.
All right. Bye.
Bye, guys.
Cold pie.